Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. In no particular order on the program today, superheroes, retail sales, and the Shanghai Auto Show. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City, once again today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 18th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a tribute to you, the American consumer. Time and again, this economy has threatened to throw up its hands and say, that's it. I am just going to stop trying to be so good. And you, yes, you have simply refused to let it. How do we know? Well, we know because the government told us so. Retail sales numbers came out this morning, quite spiffy, thank you very much. Up more than 1.5% month to month, up 3.5% from a year ago. On the other hand, prior performance, as we know, is no guarantee of future results because a separate survey on consumer confidence came out this week as well, and it showed that the percentage of Americans who think it's a good idea to buy stuff right now has actually fallen. So Marketplace's Mario Segarra has this look at how to reconcile this positive moment in retail with a more cautious outlook.
The retail sales numbers out this morning are good, really good. Especially compared to the previous couple of months, when they were kind of terrible. Joel Bynes is a managing director at Alex Partners.
We had the government shut down. We had bad weather. We had a lot of things conspire against us in December, January, and February that I think really tamped down the numbers. And clearly, we've put that behind us, and the consumer is back spending and spending in a big way.
Spending online and in person on things like cars and beauty supplies and gardening equipment. So there's that. There's also the new data from the Conference Board. Senior researcher Denise Dalhoff says Americans continue to feel optimistic about the economy at large and
consumers feel very good about, you know, job prospects, about their personal financial situation.
But then there was a question about spending. Do you think now is an excellent, good, not so good, or bad time to buy goods and services? From the end of last year to the first quarter of this year, the percentage of Americans who said excellent or good dropped from 60 to 58%, which, yeah, isn't so much, but it is noticeable. Dalhoff says the reason could be uncertainty over things like trade negotiations. But what can we make of the difference between the actual retail sales numbers and the Conference Board data? Dalhoff says the Conference Board's question was an indication of consumers' intentions.
And between your intentions and what you actually do, a lot can happen.
Maybe you're planning to cut back on eating out to save money. But then one night you get home late from work and you just don't feel like cooking.
You know, I've been following retail for 25 years. I will always put my faith in the hard numbers versus what consumers tell us they might do in the future.
Joel Bynes at Alex Partners says the hard numbers, like low unemployment and rising wages, tell him that people are going to keep spending money, whether they think so or not. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You probably don't pay him as much mind as you might think as you're going about your day in this economy, but the letters that follow company names, I'm talking Inc. or LLC or LP, they say a whole lot. And therein lies the twist to today's news from Wall Street. The private equity firm Blackstone, which controls nearly $500 billion worth of real estate and hedge funds and a boatload of other things, it announced this morning that the letters at the end of its name are going to change from LP, Limited Partnership, to Inc. In other words, it's becoming a corporation. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what the change means and why Blackstone might be making it now.
As big as Blackstone is, in some ways it operates like a small business. Each shareholder is a partner. Kimberly Clossing is an economics professor at Reed College. She says operating this way means
that you can trade the stock, although it's limited in how many people can trade it, and the stock can't be on an index fund, so that's a disadvantage.
What she means is there are rules preventing index funds from holding these types of shares, and some mutual and pension funds just don't want to bother with the extra paperwork of buying into a partnership. Blackstone says that limit on demand is holding down its share price. So why be a partnership in the first place?
Prior to 2018, there were big tax advantages associated with staying a pass-through business, which a partnership is.
That all changed under the new tax law when the corporate tax rate dropped from 35% to 21%. So partnerships like Blackstone started rethinking how they were set up, says Jennifer Bluen, an accounting professor at the Wharton School of Business.
And I think the new legislation with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act may have made their decision to convert a little bit more profitable.
Blackstone's peer, KKR, made the switch last year, and at first its shares took off, says Greg Philbeck, a finance professor at Penn State Barrand. He says Blackstone has been watching all this play out.
Following the initial euphoria with KKR, for example, they may want to have waited to see over time if this euphoria would wear off.
It did. KKR's shares have come back down to earth, but between greater access to investors and a not too painful tax hit, Blackstone has decided the switch is worth it. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Yes, the day was dominated by, shall we say, that other story. Traders, though, didn't seem to care one way or t'other. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The streets of Manhattan didn't feel less crowded today, but the Census Bureau says otherwise. Numbers out this morning show New York City's population fell last year for the first time in a decade, down about 0.5% or so. Elsewhere in the data is this nugget that the share of population growth in this economy that's being driven by immigration has risen steadily over that same 10-year period, in part because the birth rate is falling and the population is aging. One of the places you can see how those demographic trends are playing out is in Texas, which the Census Bureau points out has four of the country's 10 fastest growing counties. From KUT in Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on that one.
Richardson, Texas, a suburb northeast of Dallas, has been Shizuru Miller's permanent home for 8 years now. She's from Tokyo.
To be honest, going to Texas was kind of shock.
She says she had trouble finding an Asian supermarket or even Japanese cuisine near her home. But she says things are changing.
Many Asians are now here, so that makes me just comfortable right now.
And the numbers back up what Miller's seeing. Lloyd Potter is Texas state demographer.
We've seen a real shift away from immigration from Latin American countries and a real significant increase in the percentage and the number of immigrants coming from Asian countries.
Census estimates show immigrants made up more than 100,000 of the almost 380,000 people Texas added between 2017 and 2018. And the Dallas-Fort Worth area, where Miller lives, gained more residents than any other metropolitan area in the country. Potter says the state's strong economy drives people here, but it's also cost of living.
So if you were in California, you could come to Texas, take a job, take a cut in pay, drive a new car, and you'd still be saving more money than you were when you were living in California.
The Census Bureau categorizes population growth into three areas: the number of births versus the number of deaths, people who move from somewhere else in the U.S., and those who come from abroad.
Different parts of Texas actually show each part of this story.
Jed Kolko is chief economist at the job website Indeed.com.
Houston and Dallas are great examples of strong growth thanks to international migration. Austin and San Antonio show off what growth from domestic migration looks like.
And in El Paso, McAllen, and other border cities, birth rates are higher. And Coco says there's one more factor driving people to Texas: relatively affordable housing. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Sure, you got your Iron Mans and your Thors and your Wonder Womans and your Captain Marvels, but you also got the Tick. Yes, the Tick, a super strong, super simple hero who's developed his own cult fan base through comics and animated series, a short-lived live-action show, and now in a new incarnation, streaming on Amazon. As it happens, Ben Edlund, the creator and guardian, in a way, of the Tick, lives about a five-minute drive from Marketplace World headquarters in L.A.
All right, first of all, we're in the wilds of Echo Park. All right, there's a skull and bones on the porch, so that's okay. Wow, look at all this stuff.
So, of course, like we stopped by.
Hey, how are you? I'm Kai.
Kai,
nice to see you.
Yeah.
How are you? Thanks for taking the time. Pay no attention to the microphone.
I won't. It's totally natural.
We took a quick tour. More skulls inside, shelves and shelves of various tchotchkes, books, comics, and otherwise. And then my eye caught something big and blue.
Talk to me about this thing. Because this is why we're here, right?
Yeah, that's the Tick. That's the Tick. So this is actually a mass-produced Halloween costume version of the Peter Serafinowicz mask. I'm thrilled at how good it is. You can get one yourself. I'm not plugging it. I'm just amazed.
No, but you can get one yourself.
I've never looked more disturbing than when I put that on myself.
So here's why I pointed it out. I saw an interview with you where you said the costume that you guys have finally come to with this show, you said it's a work of art.
This one really is how I would have drawn it or did draw it as a form. And it's like, I really enjoy it now.
So look, you've been doing this character since you were 17?
Yes.
So here you are now, having lived with this thing for 30-something years. Is it what you thought it would be when you were 17? Now seeing it on screen in a fully realized thing? I mean, there have been other versions of it, but this one seems to be the one that's sticking.
I didn't imagine this, because this is something that I don't know if I was capable of imagining. It incorporated doing what I was doing at that time, developing the character, allowing the character to kind of evolve when I was away from it, some objective distance to build, but also years of actually learning how to make TV.
Yeah, because you do a bunch of other stuff, we should say. You've done bunches of other TV.
Yeah, I mean, I've learned. Like, it took about 15 years of craft building on other, like, really extraordinary creators' shows.
Did Amazon come to you, or did you go to Amazon?
I went to Amazon. Actually, Barry Josephson came to me, who was one of the producers on the previous live action. Mm-hmm. I was resistant, but then it ate at me. And I started to realize there was a way of doing it. And obviously, to me, superheroes culturally existed in a totally different space. They were much more present. The saturation had really...
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even realize. I thought we were going to peak. That was 4 years
ago.
Have
you met Disney?
No. Well, I mean, yeah.
Right? You know.
Anyway, yeah. So it's been quite a ride for this character.
In this day and age, right, where you got Disney and Marvel and the universes and Star Trek and Star Wars and all of that, right,
yes,
where it's a giant conglomerative multi-billion-dollar enterprise at almost every turn, can somebody like you come along and carry the Tick through the next 30 years?
The next 30 years?
Yeah. You know, their own creation, whatever it is.
I mean, I would say that this has made a strange cultural footprint. It is very persistent. It is persistently underground. And even now, we have yet to break through what would be considered sort of the mainstream, you know. We have not yet done for superhero comedy what The Walking Dead did for zombies.
No, but you're on public radio, so that's a start.
Well, this is, you know, this is a big day for us, and believe me. But I mean, look, it's like, it's not easy to hang around. Yeah. Like, it's easier to just sort of fade out because there's so much fatigue. That's going to be the biggest challenge, is to somehow move forward with this show and embrace the fatigue people are already feeling, have been feeling for a while, and somehow have the characters triumph over their setting.
I mean, you have creative control over this thing, right?
I mean, as much as you could, yeah.
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 What's that like? Is it a pleasure or is it a responsibility is a better question?
Yeah, that's the right question. It has started to get pleasurable. It started in a very daunting place because I had been the steward of each one of the previous things, so and each one had its own sort of niche of success in a way, even if the live action previously hadn't made some multi-season sort of impact, it was a cult favorite. Just the character's essence had been kind of well maintained, so to do it again was terrifying.
Would you be offended if I said this is a quirky little show?
I don't think so. Let me think about it.
Because that's, I mean, that's
No, I'm wildly offended. Holy man. No, what's funny, I think Amazon might be offended because they spend a lot of money on this show. But, like, it is kind of a quirky little show. I mean, like, it's over in the corner of the great sort of the baffling superhero dance that has become our culture and is sort of snickering, making fun, but too scared maybe and to that's, fully dance.
That's where you want to be.
I kind of, yeah. That's where I was during my junior high school dances. That's where I found myself.
Yeah, you and me both. But that's a whole different interview.
All right.
Ben, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
We took some cameras with us when we went out to Ben's house, shot some video of all his collectibles and curiosities. Check it out on our YouTube channel. We are Marketplace APM. And hey, as long as you're there, subscribe too. Coming up.
I go to Walmart. I go to Family Dollar. I've got prices pretty well memorized.
Pricing and purchasing your groceries. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 110 points today, about 0.4%, ended to 26,559. The NASDAQ basically flat, 79.98. S&P 500 up 4 points, about a 0.1%. 29.5. Union Pacific charged up 4.3% today. The railroad company posted better than expected first quarter profits. Honeywell International sweetened 3.7% first quarter earnings and sales topped expectations. Raytheon up about 1%. Toolmaker Stanley Black & Decker, tougher to say than you think. Stanley Black & Decker banged up 0.7% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 2.55%. And you, yes you, you're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai. I want to tell you about another podcast from Marketplace. It's called The Uncertain Hour. This season goes deep inside the war on drugs because to understand how we've handled the opioid crisis so far, you need to go back in history, starting 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush held up an actual baggie of crack cocaine during his first national televised speech. There is, though, a strange backstory to where that baggie of crack came from, and it's a moment we've been dealing with ever since. The new season is out now. Listen and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Told you yesterday about some stronger than expected economic growth numbers out of China, numbers that surprised pretty much everybody. Not partaking in the good news, though, was the Chinese automobile industry. Car sales have slid 9 straight months over there, which is, not for nothing, the world's biggest car market. So, our China correspondent Jennifer Pak went to the Shanghai Auto Show this week to see what American car makers are doing to attract Chinese consumers.
At the auto show, car maker Chevrolet plays a video outlining the history of its SUVs. The first was created in 1935. That first model, the Suburban Carryall, was a huge hit, says Chevrolet. Now it wants to replicate that success in China by launching two smaller SUVs aimed at young and tech-savvy consumers. Rival automaker Ford is chasing the same customers. The company says its sales in China for the first quarter of this year fell by 36%.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm Tim.
Nice to meet
Tim
you.
Tim Slatter is the head of product development for Ford in China. He says Chinese consumers want a car that looks good and is equipped with the latest tech. The newest model from Ford includes an artificial intelligence system for information and entertainment.
Okay, so this is the five-door Focus. This is the ST line model. Customers can choose a really exciting looking vehicle with, you know, suspension tuning that's sportier. If you'd like to jump in,
okay.
I think we've got someone who can
yes.
quickly
okay.
show you
okay.
the Sync Plus.
Oh, sorry. And so your name?
My name is Jessica Zhou.
Jessica. Okay. Yeah. Jessica's going to run me through the system here because it's all in Chinese, right? There's no English.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Okay. So tell me, what does it do? 你可以给我解释一下这个怎么操作的。
你好,福特。
Think of me as a personal secretary, the system says. It can help check the weather or find the best restaurants and movies. It also has iQIYI, which is like the Netflix of China.
Ah, so it just stopped the video.
Okay. Using only voice command, Jessica can start, stop, or skip to the next TV episode. The system uses artificial intelligence from Chinese tech firm Baidu.
So do you think that this is going to give you the edge?
It's one of the things which is going to give us an edge here in China.
And what works here in China, says Ford, could soon show up in a car near you. At the Shanghai Auto Show, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Selling food and groceries writ large might seem like a straightforward business model, right? People got to eat, so they're going to have to buy at least some of what you're selling. But in actual practice, that is not always the case. Regional supermarket companies being the most glaring current example. A lot of them are losing sales and market share to some big national and even international chains. Amazon's already got Whole Foods. European discount supermarkets are expanding across the United States. And Walmart is actually already the biggest grocer in the country. Marketplace's Renata Sago has this look from Orlando at how some of those regional players are fighting back.
It's in the parking lot of an Orlando Winn-Dixie where I find Jim Milam. He's in his 80s and lives on a fixed income. He has less than $100 a month to spend on groceries, so he's always on the prowl for a deal.
I go to Walmart. I go to Family Dollar. I've got prices pretty well memorized.
Take the price of a 12-pack of Coke. It's about $3.50 at Milam's go-to discount stores. Here at his Winn-Dixie, which has about 500 stores across the South,
they're about $5.
Even though prices for some products are higher, he finds himself pushing a cart of groceries out of here a couple of times a month.
I'm only, $6 from here.
Winn-Dixie is one of the regional chains that suffered recently. Its parent company filed for bankruptcy last year and closed dozens of stores. The low-margin grocery business has always been a little unstable. Chains come, chains go. It's been that way almost since the first modern supermarket opened. That was in Memphis in 1916, and the store was called Piggly Wiggly. It pioneered a self-service shopping model. Historian Benjamin Davison says before this store opened,
you had to go to the counter and talk to a clerk, and they would pull your products for you. You couldn't really, go and touch and feel what you were going to buy.
Soon, other retailers followed suit, and by the 1950s, grocery chains were hitting their stride. In this 1950s promo footage, we meet a manager at Mayfair, a bygone Western regional grocer. The manager takes his son to work and tells him that his job is to make sure there's enough food on the shelves, and
I must also see that all the people who work in the market know what to do and that they do their jobs well.
Grocery chains offered conveniences like parking, and their purchasing power meant lower prices. Today, convenience is not enough. Walmart, Target, and Amazon, they're pretty convenient. So regional grocers have to specialize. Take Publix, which owns 1,200 stores in the South. It's one of the regional supermarkets that seems to be successfully navigating the choppy waters. It posted higher sales in 2018 and just paid a dividend to its shareholders. A longtime Publix employee, Dwayne Stevens, took me on a tour of a Southeast Orlando store. There's a sandwich station and prepared foods. I'm talking hot wings and Gouda mac and cheese. You can watch bread and cakes being made.
We can taste anything you want to taste. You have a slice of anything.
Regional supermarkets are now offering cooking lessons, in-store dietitians, just about anything that will separate them from price-driven giants. Randy Bird is with the consulting firm A.T. Kearney.
You know, you see a really strong focus on the customer. You see a focus on the shopping experience, a lot of which is interaction with store associates. And you see a focus on innovating the food offering.
And big regional chains are trying to find new niches. Publix is piloting a store in Tallahassee called Greenwise. It sells organic foods. And Winn-Dixie has started retooling some of its locations as Fresco y Más stores to better serve Latino shoppers. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I might have mentioned already, but it does seem kind of like a public service to do it again. The Mueller report was, of course, released this morning in redacted form. You can get it online for free from the Justice Department's website, or you can get it online for $10.50 from Amazon and the Washington Post, because capitalism, of course. All right, that's it. We got to go. The Dow up 110 points. That's about 0.4%. The NASDAQ basically flat on this Thursday. The S&P 500 up 4 points, about 0.1% there. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bekela, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.